Okay, I'm going to be honest with you. The content in this episode is fantastic, but I messed up the recording in a couple places, which you will probably hear, even without a trained ear. I'm sorry, and my hopes for winning the 2018 Best Technical Podcast Award at the Potties are dashed. Regardless, welcome to the Great Unsung. All I got is gone. Evicted tenant. How can a broke man be happy? Mean things happening in this land. I'm a punk rocker at heart, and those sound like some pretty good punk rock titles. But they're not. Those are the titles of folk songs from the 1930s. And I found them on the website musicfromthedepression.com. It's a website set up and maintained by Tom Naples, who's my guest this week. Tom is an authority on so many songs that defined America's most important times, including the music of the Great Depression. He's a tireless researcher. He's a great songwriter. He's an amazing storyteller. And he has a knack for reminding me, and hopefully you, about why music and songs are so important. So sit back, slow down, and let's talk about songs. Tom Naples, hello.
Hello, Allison. It's great to be here.
I'm so happy you are here on The Great Unsung. Thank you for being a part of this.
I am honored.
I hope that you have a nice time here today talking about some things I have in mind for you, okay?
Okay.
All right. The first thing I want to just say is this. This is what I do with all the people who come on. I look up other people who are named Tom Naples, and I tell you a little bit about them. Look at, I want to show you this Tom Naples here. This is Tom Naples. Take a gander. Guess what he does for a living. I'll give you three guesses. No, two.
A realtor.
Oh, how do you know? Does it say it on?
Because it says it on here.
Oh. I thought you were a genius. I thought for a minute you were a genius. Yes, he's a realtor. He's in Illinois. Okay, and I think I have to put my glasses on for this, but that Tom Naples is, he's a certified staging consultant. What do you think about that?
Is
that
what kind of what kind of
staging consultant?
I don't even know what that means.
You know what that means? When someone wants to sell a house, like you bake cookies and you put all the furniture in the right places and like, you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying.
Do you think you would be good at that?
No. I had a crack of business in another life, and I don't look back.
I think, if you don't mind, we're going to talk a little bit about that this afternoon.
About it.
Okay, you got it. You give me two sentences, and I'll be happy, but not right now, so don't get nervous. This Tom Naples, he believes, I like this one little thing he said, I believe in building a professional friendship when he's talking about realty, but that idea, isn't that cool? Because in my mind, I always think, you have professional relationships and then just friends. But a professional friendship, doesn't that sort of give you the idea that, like, I'll be nice to you for a while and then I might not ever see you again, but it was nice while it lasted?
Yeah, but, you know, the fact that it's business colors it for me, it colors it grape. You know,
so
it sours
you think-
it. I think that, you know, well, business is based on capitalism, which is based on I win, you lose. There's no way we both win.
Wow, that's so...
Or if we both win, I win more. And, I mean, really, try to find an example of any business transaction.
Let's talk about it. Let's go to the realty thing. What if there's a house you love and you buy it, and the person who sells it to you is happy they sold it to you? Don't we both win?
Yeah, but a realtor maneuvers that sale. He either gets that house for you for less money than... someone else might have paid, or if he's representing the seller, he gets more money than someone else would have paid for it.
All right. Well, forget that. We're not going to go down that road. Let's talk about some other Tom Naples. Well, the only thing I want to tell you is look at this list of Tom Naples that are currently on this planet, in this country. There's like It's a common name. Did you ever know that?
No, but I knew there's some guy in New England, I think, who is a very cool guy. He's a social worker.
Really?
And I've come across things, maybe on Facebook or somewhere, his name. And really just seems like a terrific guy.
He might be the one in New Haven or West Haven, Connecticut. He's 41 years old. There's a lot. Let's look for other New England's. Newington, Connecticut. Thomas P. Naples. What's your middle initial?
P.
Oh my gosh.
Well, that might be me.
Have you ever lived in Newington, Connecticut?
I travel a lot, you know.
All right. Well, I did not know that your name is a common name.
Actually, I didn't either, but
now you do. So you already learned something. Aren't you happy you came here today?
Yeah. And if you'll let me keep this picture of this guy, I'll have a business card made.
Yes, I will let you keep that picture of that guy. You've got it.
I'll have a business card made, and I'll just take that realty out, and I'll start using it and say, well, that was before the accident.
Well, but you do have to say that you have to create professional friendships with people if you use that picture, because that's his thing. That's his deal.
Okay.
You got to just abandon all of your ideas about capitalism, okay? Okay. I want to say this and see if you agree with me. When I try to think of a title for who you are, what you do, right? I like to call you a musicologist. Do you fall into that realm?
Well, I think so, but I have to tell you, I don't really know what that word means.
It's sort of an umbrella word. Like, it covers a lot. There's, like, sociology-type people. Mm-hmm. And you are, in a way, a sociologist, I would say.
Well, I'm a person with a historical bent.
Yes.
You know, I'm not a historian, because, by definition, historians have a certain amount of formal education.
Okay, so putting that aside. But I think maybe musicologist, I don't think you have to have the letters after your name for that. So maybe you could start saying that.
I could. I suppose I could.
That's someone who, in one of its forms, is someone who studies music and how it reflects a culture.
Yeah, and I mean, that is my why I'm so drawn and always have been to folk music, because it comes from oral history, which really comes from individuals' interpretation of events. It doesn't actually have to be factually correct. It's an individual's interpretation.
And by the way, isn't all of history that exact thing? I mean, like, we can know dates. Okay, building burned down on this date, but every part of history is just someone's interpretation of something that happened, right?
But oral historians are like the black sheep of the academic world, even though they're educated, PhDs and all that, because they just operate on a different basis. They operate on a basis of, it doesn't matter how many planes went down at Pearl Harbor. What matters to them is somebody's impression of what happened at Pearl Harbor. And if they say 10,000 planes went down, which is not true, that's what it felt like to them.
That's oral history. Okay.
And that, in a way, tells us more about what happened.
Why? You say in a way. Why? Why? Why?
Well, because I think people's impressions are more honest than... remember, history is always written by the winners. Mm-hmm. And so... You got to be a little bit skeptical, Mm-hmm. And the numbers really aren't important. I mean, can I digress and tell you a story?
Please.
My mother had a brother-in-law who was a lot older than her. My mother was the youngest. And during the Depression, she told me, she said, my Uncle Angelo went every day, walked from 7th Street to the Broadway Market and bought a bushel of apples. And he walked all the way home. And his wife made candy apples, and then he walked all the way back downtown and sold them outside a movie theater so they wouldn't have to go on relief. Now, that's an impossible thing. You couldn't do that every day. There weren't enough people going to movies. It's totally impractical. But my mother was an adolescent young woman, and that was her impression. That's how she remembered it. She remembered this guy and his wife did everything they could do to stay off relief.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the lesson there. Doesn't matter if he did it 3 days a week, 2 days a week. That's really what oral history. So in folk music is pretty much the same thing. I mean, look at all those Woody Guthrie songs. He did that song Pretty Boy Floyd. There is nothing in that song that is true. I mean, Pretty Boy Floyd was a ruthless killer, shot people in the back, and Guthrie makes him into a folk hero.
Is, but he, the is truth that the is, line where he says some people kill him with a fountain pen?
Like yeah, he, because what was true was that the people in Oklahoma loved him, even though he was a killer, because one of the things he did was after he held up a bank, he burnt the bank records, the mortgage records. Mm. There wasn't a disc somewhere. So farmers got 6-7 months without having to pay their bills because they couldn't figure out what they were. He saved farms.
And why did he do that?
He hated banks. Uh-huh. And so there's a song. It's not factually true, but the events in it are not.
And people can relate to the message or the theme.
Yeah,
in it.
He didn't go to people's houses and leave $1,000 bill underneath his plate. And when he begged a meal. But he saved a lot of people. He saved their farms. And that is what that folk song did. I mean, there's many other examples, but that's a very good example. And it reflects oral history. So I've always been drawn to history and oral history. It's and hearing people's impressions of things rather than statistics.
Hear me out on this theory. And you're going to hate me for this. Do you think that reality television of this era has a similar lean as folk songs? Because guess what reality does? It presents a reality and how
the creator
wants it to be seen.
I say no because my daughter always used to kid me because I always used to call it unreality television. I think it's too staged. I don't think there's no reality.
It could have been staged by your alter ego, Tom Naples. But
did you see the one about the realtor? And, no. So the other confession is, you know, I haven't owned a TV in 10 years, so
okay.
I don't know any of these shows. But I don't really think that's oral history. I think that is.
I'm not saying that's oral history. I'm saying it's creating a. It's creating a real reality that you want people to see or to get a certain response to.
Yeah, but you can create this reality that is dishonest. Oral history is honest in that it is someone's impression.
Someone's real impression of it.
Yeah, I mean, they may be factually incorrect.
There's the
difference. That's the thing, like with Pretty Boy Floyd. So Woody writes this song, and, you know, there's no record that he ever donated a wagon full of food to Oklahoma City to feed people on relief. There's just no record of that at all. There's no record that he killed a cop because the guy talked dirty in front of his wife. It's absurd. He was a mean, mean guy, but the people in Oklahoma thought he was a hero because of other things that he did.
Let's talk about Woody Guthrie for a second then, because, you know, Woody Guthrie, everybody knows he lifted melodies from the public domain, right? This land is your land. Okay, so mm-hmm. Why would Woody Guthrie take such poetic license with these things? What was his purpose? Why was he writing these songs?
You know, I'm not sure, but Guthrie was a possessed man. You know, he wrote, I mean, they found 3,000 songs that no one's ever heard that were just lyrics. He would type them. He worked on a typewriter, and they would find him asleep at the kitchen table in the morning with his head on the typewriter and the floor covered with papers. And, I mean, he wrote them faster than he could sing them or learn them. He was just really obsessed with writing. And he wrote a novel as well.
He did. I did not know that.
Yeah, they just released it about 2 or 3 years ago.
By the way, Prince was also prolific like that. They just keep finding songs and songs. That was his life.
And I think Bob Dylan is. You know, his notebooks some of his notebooks have just been purchased and are with the Guthrie notebooks at Oklahoma State University.
I want to ask you about this. But first, let me just double check that I'm recording everything correctly.
Oh, sure.
You said some good things, and wouldn't it suck if no one can hear it? But just hold on 1 second. People, don't go away. We're going to be back in a flash. Tom, I'm doing everything just fine. You sound fantastic. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your trajectory, because we were just talking about how Woody Guthrie was like sort of immersed in songwriting. And I feel like you're immersed in a lot of the things you do, and you do them well. But I only knew you when you were this musicologist, folk singer, researcher person. I didn't know you when you had this buttoned up white collar life, right? So I want to ask you a little bit, like, just you can give me the Cliff Notes version of your trajectory.
Okay, well, I was very young and I got married and had absolutely no money. So I got a job in business. And it was because my father was in business and he gave me a job, not because I had any particular talent for it. And in a short period of time, I found out that it was, if you stayed focused, it was kind of easy, as long as you stayed focused. And it became a sport. It was like competing in a sports field. And I did it for 29 years, and I did it fairly well, but then really got to hate it, totally got to hate it. But I was, you know, I was lucky enough, I planned so that after 29 years, I could walk away.
So you sort of looked, you're a competitive person. Is that what do you think?
Yeah,
you are?
I mean, I'm losing that competitiveness as mm-hmm. I get older. I'm not very competitive now, but I was then.
So
I was very
sort of,
competitive.
That sustained you for a while, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I could see immediate benefits from it. You know, it wasn't like writing the 800-page novel that takes 7 years. You know, this was easy. And I put a lot of time in, but it was easy.
And
then I had a family. That ended in divorce, and I had a second wife, and had a couple kids. And it enabled us. It was money, you know.
Right.
It enabled us
so
to take travel, go,
yeah.
You know. And
you
so
were a provider. During all those years, did you ever have in the back of your mind this idea that you wanted to pursue sort of a more creative life?
Oh, yeah. There was a plan that I was not going to do this
really
forever. Yeah. I mean, I wanted to get my kids through school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was 49 when I bailed.
Was it scary at all, or were you happy?
I think it's like anybody who retires from anything. The first year was really hell. And then a few things fell into place, and then it just got right on track. And mm-hmm. as it turns out, the first door that opened was children's music. And that was just fabulous. And I did it for 7 years.
You were going to school?
Well, Peggy Milleron and I, who's just a terrific singer and teacher, we got grants and we did programs for inner city schools for pre-K children. And it was participatory. They had, you know, rhythm sticks and different drums, and we'd show them the guitar and the banjo.
Oh,
and
simple stuff like that, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then we used folk songs to teach them sequencing, rhyming, and we did over 2,000 workshops in 7 years.
You did over 2,000 workshops in 7 years.
Yeah.
Amazing. Were you feeling competitive with the kids, like where you're trying to outplay them?
That's how I got into playing. And it's very simple music, but if you can call it playing in public, I was playing in public.
It's true. You had 2,000 gigs. And
the audience averaged 4 years old, but
but hey, you get them early.
And I will say that of all the things I've done in my life, most things that I've done, except some particular charitable things, have benefited me or my family. That was something that benefited someone else, and I still think it's the best thing I ever did. Was those years of doing the children's music? And the kids were great.
So. Fulfilling, rewarding in different ways that you weren't used to.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and you could see that it made a difference, especially if they had a good teacher, because we would give the teacher a CD of 10 songs, and you know, we'd come back the next year and she'd say, "We used it all year long."
That's awesome.
You know? And
tell me about the disservice we do to our children in this country when we cut music and art programs.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know if there's... You have to be a lunatic to not believe that music is important in so many ways. I mean, the most basic way is if you want to just take the art part out, it's math. It's intervals. It's math. I mean, it's, you know, usually people that are really good in music are really good in math. And so there's that part of it. But I just think music opens so many doors. And culturally, it is how people have always expressed themselves. I mean, always have expressed themselves that way. I mean, but there have been flutes since God knows when. You know, it was probably a hollowed out piece of wood, a branch that fell and someone blew in it. And then there were flutes. And of course, drums have.
It might have been a beer bottle, too.
No, I'm talking a little bit before the beer bottle. But, so I think that it's a way it's the easiest way to learn about another culture. I mean, it's just to learn songs. Now, what people will learn about our culture is going to be interesting. They'll still do it through music, but I mean, look at electronic music. You know, that's not what you and I do, but it's very much a big part of our culture. Even if you look at the 20th century, the big band era, I mean, that tells you a lot about how people were living.
Tell me about that. Why?
Well, I mean, it was this age where there was this war hovering, and people like my parents, that they were of the age, would congregate to these theaters, to the Shays and places like that, listen to this giant band. They dance. It was a total diversion. There was no television. And then when they listened to the radio, they listened to the same music. But it was a total escape and total diversion. And this was jazz before bebop. So this was melodies that they sang at home. I don't know if you noticed, they used to sell songbooks that had no music in them, just lyrics of all the popular songs.
Really?
And I remember my mother telling me she and her sister, when they did the dishes at night, they sang, they would just go through the book and sing all these songs. And so it was and the songs were as innocent as could be in a world that was really losing its innocence fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is Hitler had already crossed Europe and these big bands were playing and it was, so it showed a lot about that culture.
Like, so let's talk about the music of the Depression.
Okay.
You said in an interview that in fact that these songs are optimistic. They're not depressing, right?
And that's correct, yes.
Do you feel like you gravitate towards that or that appeals to you partially because it helps you do the same thing sometimes?
No, I it may be in my subconscious, but what that music means to me is I think that the Depression was America's finest hour. Is the Depression was worldwide. And at the end of the Depression, Italy had an election and had elected Mussolini. Germany had elected Hitler. No offense to the Brits, but they couldn't find their ass with both hands. Spain had elected Franco. And we had Social Security. We had the WPA that employed 8 million people. We got art all over this country that still exists in murals. We got books on travel for every single state. I mean, theater. John Houseman ran the theater project in New York in the 1930s. And that was all during the Depression and how we put people back to work.
Are you saying that Franklin Roosevelt created these all these programs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the government gave money to all these things.
Right. But what happened was, I mean, the golden era of folk music was not the 1950s, it was the 1930s. That's where all this stuff came from. The Library of Congress gave people money, like the Lomaxes, and sent them out and said, your job is to find songs before they're lost. And it was just the right time because there was some recording equipment.
So you're saying the government said to these people, go out and find songs in the camps, right in the, what did they call them?
Oh, not only that.
Hoovervilles and stuff like that.
Go door to door in the South. Just take these folk songs that have never been recorded anywhere and let's save them.
And isn't that the first example of the musician getting screwed? Not that any money was made off of it, but I'm sure these musicians at the time were like...
It is, because they did it with photography as well. And those Dorothea Lange and those great photographers they hired, they got a salary. So those famous pictures, Migrant Mother, she didn't get 5 cents for that picture. The government says go out and get it. You can't copyright it if the government's paying you to collect it.
Yeah.
You know, so the same thing with the songs. I mean, these were all public domain, but it wasn't until much later, like A.P. Carter started copywriting these songs, and they were traditional songs.
Alison Pipitone Carter, A.P. Carter.
I've been meaning to ask you about that. What? So anyway, so that drew me to the Depression. I just, as a amateur historian, I thought that period is the most fascinating.
Yeah.
And that people didn't give up. We had some labor issues, very minor compared to the rest of the world. I mean, there were some strikes, but we did not burn down cities. You know, I mean, the labor, there were a lot of fights, but it was relatively calm compared to the rest
relatively
of the world.
Relatively speaking,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and out of it, you know, we got unions. We got unions out of that. You know, we got collective bargaining, which at one time was illegal in this country.
And which soon might be again.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, but that's a whole different story, right?
Yeah.
The people who wrote the songs, right, they were just, that was another form of folk history, right?
Oh yeah, because the songs changed constantly. You know, he's passed now, Archie Green, but he was a folklorist and wrote some great books about it. But he really gave an interesting definition of what is a folk song, and his idea was that it changes hands seven times, or just through oral. I sing it for you, you learn it, you sing it for him, he learns it. This is before CDs.
And it's the seventh person to hear it, Kevin Bacon.
his brother.
Okay.
But so it's by word of mouth. Now today that's impossible because we don't go over each other's house at night just to play songs.
So what's the seven thing with that? Well, his theory was what?
Well, I don't know why he came up with seven as an arbitrary number, but it was just that it moves through society, and it gets changed every time it goes.
Gotcha.
And, you know, there's this very famous song, Barbara Allen. It's a British song. And there's like 164 versions of that song that have been documented. Slight changes in melody, slight changes in story, but distinctly different.
164.
Yeah.
And so really, who owns it? It's sort of like...
Oh, it's public domain. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what the definition of folk music is. I do know that one time the blues singer Big Bill Brunsey was talking to Pete Seeger, and he had done a song, and Seeger asked him if that was a folk song. And his answer was, it must be. I never heard a horse sing it. So, I mean, the definitions, and they kind of become somewhat meaningless, especially in the era we live in now.
Is it the kind of thing with you that you sort of opened up the door to this world and you just keep going deeper and deeper and there's more and more to learn about?
Yeah, yeah. And it's a little different now because I'm not a collector. I gather the songs. Someone already did the collecting. All those people in the 20s and 30s, they did the collecting. They got them down in, you know, crude machines, and the Library of Congress got them. And so it's...
Well, you're sort of unearthing them. You're like an archaeologist because they're there, but... You're reintroducing them.
But what these collectors did is they knocked on your door. I mean, I've got some old recordings where they actually knock on someone's door, you know, and they say, do you know any spirituals who tried to collect these songs from this county in North Carolina? And they'd come out and sing them a song. If you take the idea of Southern folk music, I mean, these were people that pretty much couldn't read or write. And they would retune their fiddle for each song because they have very limited skills. So they would just keep tuning the fiddle so they could play the same pattern and just, you know, change the tone by changing the string.
I do that sometimes with my band, with my guitar. I do. Don't tell anyone.
They must love it.
It's my secret, yeah. Tom, I need to tell our audience that I did an abrupt stop of our interview because it's so boiling hot up here. I was getting overheated, so we had to stop and put the air conditioning on for a little bit.
You know, that never happens when I'm with a woman.
Well, today's your lucky day because it just happened. But it gave me the opportunity to think about the fact that we're getting away from one thing I wanted to make sure we talk about, and that's your own songwriting. You have such a vast history of knowledge of folk songs and songs and stories. And I want to just mention the fact that you do such an amazing job of writing your own songs.
Thank you.
I think that's huge. And I think you pay such attention to words and detail and image. And those are all the things that I love about good songwriting. So can we talk a little bit about your own songwriting?
Sure, sure. I think it's probably two categories. I really like laboring over words and trying to write poetic songs, but I even get tired of listening to them. The songs that stick are story songs, and that's because I like telling stories. I like hearing stories. And, you know, Dave Van Ronk, I think it was Dave Van Ronk, said once, I can tell a lie, but I can't sing one. And and so I tell stories in my songs that are all true. And as you know, I travel around and I meet a lot of people and I hear all kinds of stories. And they work their ways into songs. And for no good reason, except that I like to, it's kind of that broadside thing. It's kind of just spreading the word through song. I think that songwriting is a very self-indulgent thing. I mean, unless you're Carole King, you know, and, you know, who was used to be up when she was young up in Brill Street in New York, the Brill Building, and pumping out these rock and roll hits, and Neil Diamond did that. But unless you're doing that, it's pretty self-serving, you know. And
I agree with that.
Yeah. I used that example. They were professional songwriters who just wrote hits for other people early in their careers, both Neil Diamond and Carole King. And so it was a profession for them. It was a job. They just went and sat in a room with a piano. And but later they started writing songs for themselves. But for most of us who don't, you know, do that type of songwriting, it's very self-indulgent.
I don't think it's a bad thing. Yeah, can't you say that in a different way? Because self-indulgent sort of has negative connotations, and I think there's really nothing negative about
it. Well, I don't mean it to be negative, but I think it is... you know, it's a very private thing, and it's and if you go out and say, "Here's a song I wrote," it's just always a little. I always have a push and pull with that. You know?
You do?
Yeah, yeah.
What's the push?
Well, the push is that you want someone to hear the song. You've created something.
And what's the pull?
You don't want to brag about it, you know? You know,
it's, all right.
That's with me. That's always been a push and pull. I used to do songs and I would not tell people I wrote them.
Yeah.
And
I think that's...
And hope they'd ask.
I get the luxury of being observational in this interview capacity as the interviewer, right? And I see with you, and this theme really runs throughout... Most talented people that I know and that I've interviewed, they're super humble and modest, and that's a good thing. But I think there's also something to be said for just acknowledging, like, sort of like the gift part of it. Not everybody can write a song. And what you do by writing songs, you're really offering something to people because you what you tell or the emotions that you convey, it resonates with somebody. And a lot of times it makes their life just a little bit better. So, like, I feel like I get it, the push and the pull. I get it. I get how you're like, oh, my God, who do I think I am? Just, it's like reading your diary.
Yeah.
Right? But it's really not that. It takes on a life of its own, in my opinion.
Oh, I think you're probably right. I think I'm just hung up on that.
Yeah.
It's still hard for me to try to take credit for a song or... You know, it's just weird to me because if the song never, if none of my songs ever left my living room, I would have the same amount of songs.
Do you, in your 29 years in the business world you were in, did you write songs?
Oh, yeah. I wrote a lot of songs.
You did?
Yeah. Yeah. I have this, rather undisciplined habit of not saving things. You know, when notebooks get full, I tend to throw them out. And because I don't, you know.
I used to, when I was like in my 20s, I thought that, well, I'm going to save these because someday someone will want to see them. At a certain point, I realized, no, they don't. So I just,
that's how I am. I think, like, what am I saving these for? I move so frequently. I'm carrying these boxes of notebooks, right. You know? And, So then my kids are going to have to throw them out. So.
All right, wait, let's talk about you traveling so much. I couldn't do it. I'm a little too scared. I'm scared of I don't even know what. I need my comfort, not my comfort, but I need familiar things around me. It's very easy for me to get lost, not physically, like mentally. Like, I'm like, I need something to ground me. That's why it would scare me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess I'm just the opposite of that. I like to be in not that I like to be uncomfortable. I like to be in places I haven't been before, situations I haven't been in
before.
How
do you navigate that? Give me an idea, like, because I know you spend a lot of time in the Southwest. Let's just say we're talking about New Mexico. So you roll into town, you don't know anybody. What do?
Find a place to sleep.
Okay.
That's essential. Okay. And depending on how long I've been traveling, find a laundromat.
Okay.
And then I find a tavern. I find a bar. And I sit down at a bar. And 99% of the time, I end up meeting somebody and talking to them. And many, many years ago, when I was in high school, there was a retired dock worker from San Francisco named Eric Hoffer. And he was what they call an armchair philosopher. He wrote some books after he retired. He was in his 70s. He was a German immigrant. He had been a migrant worker. He had done all these things. And they did several shows called The Two Erics. It was Eric Severide, who you may remember was a CBS reporter. Yes. And they would sit in these chairs across from each other. And Hoffer was so brilliant. They would talk about everything from the Peloponnesian Wars to Lyndon Johnson. And they just... all over the place. And Hoffer said something that stuck with me, and I suppose if it changed my life, is he said to Severide, he said, you know, when I traveled all over picking peas up and down California before I settled, you know, working on the docks, he said, I met all kinds of people. And he said, people's lives are very interesting, you know, and we're in a country that's so divided, but one-on-one, even today, one-on-one, we find that we have a lot more common themes running through.
I agree. Like, for example, you and me, we do not like each other in real life. It's just, it's just more one-on-one. We found some common ground.
I know. And, you know, for those few times we're together, I have to, you know, stop talking about you. But, and so that's all woven into the traveling. So we could probably blame Eric Hoffer for that.
And so tell me about the playing music with the traveling. How does that happen?
You know, if I'm in a place for any length of time, I try to, you know, I'll scout it out if there's some joint like that's got some music.
Or whatever, yeah.
And I have had better luck in the Southwest than in the Northeast finding places to play. And interestingly enough, places that want you to play original music. Which is just...
What do you attribute that to?
I don't know. But I know in the town I spend a lot of time in, Silver City, New Mexico, I mean, all these places, I don't think there's any cover bands. I mean, you're expected to play a good mix of your own songs.
Really?
Yeah. So I found that, and I have no idea why that is, but... So if I'm in that situation, like when I go there, I pick up a couple of gigs, but that's how the music comes. And then I write a lot of songs when I'm traveling about the people I've met or at least get them started. They might not finish them, you know, for a while.
Yeah, you probably take some license with character traits. Or, like, you know what I mean?
Well, sure as hell change names. Yeah. But the theme is pretty much all the same.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, you meet somebody who you would never meet any other way unless you were traveling, and they just push you into a song. I met a woman who was must have been around 90, and she, as a child, had gone to the opening of the of a theater in Miami, Oklahoma, where Will Rogers was playing. It's the opening night of this theater, the Coleman Theater.
Wait. Are you saying a woman you talked to was in the presence of a Will Rogers concert?
Yeah, she was born in 1920.
Dang, okay.
And so, and her father took her and her sister and her mother by horse carriage to this grand, spectacular theater. And so in this conversation with her about the theater, at the theater, because I was taking a tour of it, we got into this conversation about train stations and what a big part of everybody's life the train station was in small towns, and it was pretty easy to put a song together after that. When I I call it the station, but I mean that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been in Miami, Oklahoma, talking to this woman who could tell me about those train stations.
There's something many people hear the stories and appreciate the stories and get excited, as I do hearing them, but a lot of people aren't able to turn that into a song. And that part right there is the creative part, right?
Yeah, I think so. The songwriting is the easy part because you've got a little block, you've got a piece of paper to fill, not 380 pages. So you can take that conversation that I had with this woman and it might not be able to make a book out of it, but you got a song.
Yeah. I think what I'd like to do now is let's just take a quick little break. Then we're going to start talking about a person who you wanted to talk about their life, and we'll see why we think they're important to discuss on this podcast.
Sounds good.
All right.
Great.
Tom, I have my papers out, okay? This is the part of the show where we talk about a musician.
I thought this is where you rolled one.
No, not the papers. Kind of papers. Oh, okay. Don't get your hopes up. You picked a guy named John Stewart.
Yes.
Okay? I'm going to talk about him a little bit, all right? Mm-hmm. He was born in 1939 in San Diego. He was the son of a horse trainer. Did you know that?
Yes, I did.
Oh, my gosh. He spent his childhood and adolescence in Southern California, living mostly in the cities of Pasadena, where I lived for many years, and Claremont. Okay, so 1957, he graduates from high school. He goes to Mount San Antonio Junior College in Pomona. 57, 58, we're talking. He's active in music and theater programs. Early on, he liked guitar and banjo. His first song he wrote, he was 10 years old when he wrote a song. Do you know what it was called?
No, I don't.
It's called The Shrunken Head Boogie. All right, so now let's fast forward a little tiny bit. So this is a kid who's got, you know, two parents, California, 1950s. So he's like living a pretty good life. And okay. He starts a high school garage band. They tour Southern California colleges, coffee houses. They release one single called Rockin' Anna, which was a minor regional hit. He starts a band called he joins a band called the Kingston Trio. Mm-hmm. This is where maybe you can jump in a little bit.
Sure. Well, he got caught up in the late 50s in the folk music wave. And so he formed a folk group, which was called the Cumberland Three, which was a Kingston Trio knockoff. And they were just doing the same types of songs, but they were touring. And all this time, he continued to write songs. And the Kingston Trio were formed in 1957, and they were the most popular band in the world.
Oh, so you're saying this kid, John Stewart, when he's growing up, this is one of his idol groups.
Oh, right? Yeah. And he wrote songs for them. He was constantly following them around when they'd come to California, and he'd bring them songs, and they recorded a few of his songs. And then what happened was their banjo player, Dave Gard, and they had a fight over money, and he left the group. And so they had to audition people to replace him, and they hired John Stewart. I mean, they were his idols. And so he played with them until that group disbanded. He left the group, and that was the end of the Kingston Trio. He had been writing more songs.
Which, by the way, Reynolds, Shane, and Stewart would record a dozen albums together.
Yeah.
So the Kingston Trio recorded 12 albums, right? Taking the music of the trio into new directions, including more original material. Because before that, they had like a, it says San Francisco folk music culture in 1957, using a mixture of calypso, pop, folk.
Yeah, a lot of calypso. In fact, the name Kingston,
Jamaica, right?
Jamaica. It was a big, you know, Harry Belafonte was very, very popular at the time. And so he starts writing more songs and is developing more social consciousness. And they, you know, were personally, they were had liberal political views, but they never wanted it in their act. And
you can tell just by looking at the publicity photos. Yeah. This is like almost Pat Boone.
Yeah.
Clean cut white boys and striped shirts, matching shirts.
Matching,
right?
Yeah. And but they had this hit, this massive hit called Where While the Flowers Gone.
They didn't write that, though.
No, Pete
they?
Seeger wrote it. And but they, I mean, it was a big step for them. It was during the Vietnam War. And so anyway, he left them and went out on his own. He first had a partner, a woman he eventually married, but
Buffy Ford. Wait, can I say one thing? You might get to this, but he wrote a hit song. He wrote one hit song, it was a legitimate hit.
The big hit that he had that Billboard play was Gold.
Oh, the one I have that he wrote for somebody else was Daydream Believer.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. He wrote that for the Monkees. And he was still with the Kingston Trio. And he was actually at the Union Hall, and somebody who was producing the Monkees said, or maybe he was at a party, but anyway, they said, "Hey, John, we're looking for songs for the Monkees. Got anything?" And he said, "You know, I might have one." And it was Daydream Believer. And they recorded it, and till he, I think his wife is still getting royalties.
Mm-hmm. Anne Murray recorded that too.
Anne Murray, yeah.
It says in 1968 he toured with Robert F. Kennedy's ill-fated presidential campaign. It says that's where he met and married fellow folk singer Buffy Ford.
Yeah, they toured together. They did a lot of things by train, and they would open up the rallies when Bobby Kennedy would come into a town. And I think the song they sang was "This is Bob's Land, This Land is Your Land," something like that.
Yeah.
And
cheesy, right?
But yeah, but while he was traveling, he wrote some great songs. He was traveling through America, and the reason I brought him up to you is I think that he was the first Americana musician before anyone knew what that word meant. He was coming out of folk music. He knew rock and roll, and they had a passion for country music. And he traveled all. He was just a California boy. He lived all over California. His father, as you mentioned, was a trainer. So he grew up with horses. He grew up in racetracks, and he picked up this very rootsy part of life, even though he was living this middle class life. And when he left the Kingston Trio, he traveled all over. And
can we hear a little bit more about the Kingston Trio?
Sure. They came out of San Francisco in 1956, 1957. And two of the members, the originals, were from Hawaii, Bob Shane and Dave Gard. And Nick Reynolds was from San Diego. And they met in college. And they were preppy college guys, and they liked music. And so they started playing. And one night, this guy shows up named Frank Werber. And Werber listens to them, and he meets them after, and he says, "I'll make a deal with you guys." The rumor is they did this on a cocktail napkin. I don't know if that's true. But he said, "We form a corporation, and we each own 25%. And you do music, and I do everything else. I promote you. I get you gigs. I iron your shirts. I do everything." And they signed, and Werber turned out to be somewhat of a genius. And he invented the college concert. People didn't play colleges.
Really?
And so what he did was
that's
he figured
genius.
Three guys in a station wagon, we can drive from college to college. You know, so when they started out, their first 2 years, they did 300 gigs a year just driving around doing them. And the other thing that Frank Werber did, and I got to know Werber's family. I never met Frank, but I got to know his family. And what he did was he made them practice 7 or 8 hours a day on nights they had gigs. Like in San Francisco, they'd get a 6-week gig at a club. So their act was so polished, and they had this natural thing. These were not inside jokes that they were laughing at. This was completely staged. But I saw them many times when I was growing up. I mean, and still listen to their records once in a while. I mean, you cannot believe that this is an act. But it was. It was. They just rehearsed it so well. Mm. And Stewart was naturally funny. So he became the lead guy. He was introduced most of the songs, told all the jokes. They did it was a very entertaining concert. And so they were very popular. And then, you know, the 60s wore on. But what they did, what they accomplished is they took folk music off of the back porches. And they took traditional songs. They changed them to make them sound a little smoother. Mm-hmm. And everybody was singing these songs now. And they did a lot of historical songs, songs about wars, battles, gold rushes, they put guitars and banjos into everybody's hands.
How did they find their songs?
Well, probably the same places I find songs. They would buy a book that Alan Lomax wrote, who was a collector. That's where they found the song Tom Dooley, which was really set the whole thing off.
Yeah.
What was happening is they were running out of what they thought they were running out of suitable public domain songs. So Stewart became more important because he could write songs.
Got you. It says here Tom Dooley was their first gold record, thereby launched a major revival in folk music that would lead to and influence the careers of Bob Dylan, Peter Paul and Mary, and John Denver, among others.
Well, and Joan Baez has said publicly that she used to be ashamed to say that she liked the Kingston Trio. Because once she got into music, you know, they were so commercial. But they were just an enormous influence. In fact, at the Bob Dylan exhibit in Paris, under the influences, there's this whole section on the Kingston Trio.
They were pinstriped, but they were troubadours, and they were the messengers of songs and that were not readily available. It was the only way much of America could hear traditional songs.
Exactly. And so as a kid, I learned how to play the guitar and the banjo listening to John Stewart, because the other two members of the trio played rhythm. And he played all the guitar leads, and he played the five-string banjo. And I learned...
What did they ever do without him?
Well, Dave Gard, the guy he replaced...
That was his role?
Yeah, that was exactly his role.
Okay. On his solo career, he signed with a few different labels,
Oh, he
right?
was on a lot of labels,
Okay,
yeah.
So he signed a contract with Robert Stigwood Organization, the same organization that serviced the recording contracts for Eric Clapton, the Bee Gees, and other disco performers. It was at RSO Records that Stewart enjoyed his most commercially successful years, teaming with Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham, who were then in Fleetwood Mac. He recorded and released Bombs Away Dream Babies, which included a number 5 hit, Gold, in 1979. Yeah. He would later stop performing the song, calling it vapid and empty, meaning nothing to him, having done it for the money and to please his record company.
And he met Lindsey Buckingham because he was learning how to play the electric guitar. And he said to a friend, how does Lindsey Buckingham get those things? And, you know, Buckingham plays with his fingers. He doesn't use a pick. It's very unusual. And Stewart said, I think this guy he's like playing like a banjo player. And the guy said he is. And he learned how to play listening to your records. And then they introduced them, and they became very good friends.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. And then so when Stewart, was his label, wanted to do a real commercial album, and that's what he did. He brought in them, and he did hate the song and stopped performing it.
How Joan Baez said, she had a quote, I'm a little bit embarrassed to admit, but I was a huge fan of theirs, right? I get that, because probably a lot of people were influenced by them, but they were probably not edgy cool. They weren't cool.
I was for a long time. I would never mention them, but I just said it earlier. I still pull out one of their CDs now and then. They were really good. They were better than I even thought at the time. They would do 3-part harmony, but they would each verse they would flip roles. So it wasn't like,
dang, now come on.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, and their vocals were so incredibly interesting. And then they had a bass player who was a jazz bass player, Dean Reilly. And so he played these wild bass lines. And I met him. I interviewed him. And I said to him, you know, I said, it took me 20 years to figure out why their sound was the way it was. Because I said, I could play anything they were playing on guitar and banjo. But I said, it was you. I said, "Was your baselines?" And he was 80 when I met him, and he said, "I didn't think anybody noticed." But it was, you know, they came from a jazz background. You know, San Francisco was folk music and jazz at that period. So they got this guy, and he toured with them. And so they had a unique sound. There's no question.
In his later years, check this out. This is interesting. Over his last years, Stewart teamed up with former Kingston Trio member Nick Reynolds to offer fans the ultimate trio fantasy, performing for and with Stewart and Reynolds.
Yeah, they ran these camps, and Reynolds' widow, Leslie Reynolds, who was a friend of mine, said, Stewart is broke. And he called Reynolds up, and Reynolds said, "I'm not doing a camp." And he said, "You gotta. I need the money. You gotta." So they did a number of them, and they were pretty awful.
Why is it everybody I've been talking about in these podcasts, all the musicians we discuss, brilliant, talented people, why are so many people broke?
Well, Stewart's case was he was never a member of the Kingston Trio. Remember, they formed that corporation? So they hired him and put him on a salary when he replaced Dave Guard. So he never made the money that they made. He made more money off songwriting with them. Because you remember, in those days, they're selling millions of albums. If he has three or four songs on there,
yeah, that's an income. Yeah. So there's money there.
But you know, then when that stops, you know, he's out there trying to play gigs like we are, and not much money in it. And he had a band.
Why do you say he is the founder of Americana music, John Stewart?
There was a series of recordings he made around 70, 71, and 72, and. First of all, the subject matter of the songs are people and places in America. It's all about people in America, poor people, rich people, highways. It's like right out of the pages of Jack Kerouac. And then he put this into this, at the time, progressive music. You know, it was this combination where there was a strong acoustic guitar, but he was using pedal steel on everything. He always had percussion, and he was recording a lot in Nashville, and it really came out, in my opinion, this is Americana music. This is what, every time I hear someone say this music is Americana, there's a line from Stewart's music to that.
Super interesting. There's something, there's a California sort of country that is unique to itself, and he probably would be in that vein.
He wrote a song called California Bloodlines, and it was an incredible hit, and it was just about being in California and absorbing all that. And then he wrote lots of songs about horses, and he used to say that when he was a kid, he'd go on the infield of his father trained trotters, not thoroughbreds, so he'd lay down with his head on the ground and listen to the rhythm.
Oh, come on.
And he wrote this fabulous song about Secretariat that is just, I mean, I don't know why they didn't use it in the movie. It's just this incredible song, Let the Big Horse Run. And that influenced him a lot. And he wrote about those things. He wrote about junkies who work in barns at racetracks and, you know, all kinds of that kind of stuff. So, and it was clean. You know, he wasn't writing this from a boxcar. You know, it was clean, super produced. And, you know, his voice was clean. I mean, there's no Woody and Guthrie in there. I mean, this was a prelude to the Eagles. And I think they acknowledged it, too. They all knew him when he was doing it. And then, you know, the years go on, and it's just not, unfortunately, not sustainable. He, you know, music changes constantly. And then his music then... Some of it got weird for a few years, and then he had a couple of kind of strange albums, and then died suddenly. And his wife told me that he had had several accidents where he had severe concussions, and he slipped into dementia. Mm-hmm. And his last album that he died while they were recording it, and she said. After she left the hospital, she said, the next morning I went to the studio to take all the masters because this was never going to be released. She said the songs made no sense. It was, she said he could play, but the words were just made no sense at all. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to make sure it didn't get released.
And that was an act of love at that point.
Yeah. So, but he was very important to me and I think to a lot of people, especially people my age, you know, who knew the trio years.
I have one last area to talk about, and then I will let you go because I know it's summer. It's beautiful here in Buffalo, New York, and it's really hot up here in Podcast Central. But do you have any inclination for what your next thing you're going to take on will be? You did a whole series of songs about the Depression, and you did a whole presentation, a whole just toured on that. You have a beautiful collection of songs. What's next?
Well, in 2017, I spent the entire year researching and writing a suite of songs about immigrants from into the United States from 1880 to 1920. And so far, it's gotten zero traction. But I think it's worth trying to do something else with them. And I am working now with Elaine Gardner, who's a terrific modern dance choreographer. And we're talking about taking three or four of them and putting dance to them, as well as either paintings, have an artist, or the what we did with the Depression, still photos. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm going to play that thing out and see how that goes before anything else.
I think it's timely. The immigration thing happening here in this country in 2018 deserves reminders. Where can people hear this stuff? Can they go to TomNaples.com?
If you go to TomNaples.com, there's 13 songs are there. Chose to have them done on piano rather than guitar. And some of the songs I can't sing. I mean, they were hard to write, and I don't have the range. So I hired Mary Stahl, a fine singer, to sing the songs. And she stayed pretty close to what I wanted. But I wanted piano. There were lots of guitars around then, but everybody had a piano. You know, this music, if it had existed then, would have been played on a piano.
Would you encourage people to interpret your songs ever? Like, if because a lot of musicians listen to this, and like, what do you think about other people covering your songs?
I'd love it.
Really?
Yeah, I think that's the ultimate. I mean, if I could find a way to get my songs out, I would never perform another gig. I would just stay home and write songs.
All right, so musicians out there, time to interpret some of these important folk songs. I think you're a folk songwriter, Tom, and let's get your take on them. So, wherever you listen to this podcast, we're going to have ways for you to contact me and Tom, and we want to hear what you have to say. Like, if you have any stories or impressions about John Stewart, about folk songs, we would love to hear what you think about these topics. And furthermore, if you want to take a shot at maybe interpreting one of Tom's songs, we're going to give you ways that you could contact him here. Right, Tom?
Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you for spending your day with me.
Thank you for having me. I'm always annoyed when on NPR when they say thank you for coming by, and no one says you're welcome. They say thank you for having me.
Oh, that's true. Wait.
Let's
try it again. I didn't even notice it. Hey, Tom, thank you for coming by.
You're welcome.
Well, there you have it. Please subscribe to this podcast and please share it with your friends. Also, you can check out TomNaples.com. If you're interested in listening to his immigrant songs and maybe taking a shot at reinterpreting one of them, also go to musicfromthedepression.com. I learned a lot this week. First of all, I learned that I'm terrible at editing, and I almost just erased the whole entire episode, and I spent about 10,000 hours trying to fix my amateur moves. So there's that. But I also learned that when you're traveling to a town and you know no one, here's what you do. Step one,
get a place to sleep. Step two, find a laundromat. Step three, go to a bar and listen to people talk. And I also learned that if you get your break and you're wearing pinstripes and you have a crew cut, it's still okay to put your ear to the ground and listen to the trotters running by. See you guys next time on The Great Unsung.